Hello and welcome to Power Play for this Friday, June 11th. I'm Joyce Napier. Coming up on the show, Trudeau's back on the world stage.
This is a meeting that genuinely needs to happen because we need to make sure that we learn the lessons from the pandemic. We need to make sure that we don't repeat some of the errors that we doubtless made in the course of the last 18 months or so.
G7 leaders gather in person making big global vaccine commitments. Canada's pledging to donate 100 million vaccines. We'll size up the summit with CTV News senior political correspondent Glenn McGregor from Cornwall, UK. Then dig into the global commitments with foreign affairs MPs. And Canada's most populous province begins reopening.
I'm in the service industry myself, so patience is something that I've built up over time. So again, you know, just be patient. If you don't want to wait in line, then don't come outside today.
Ontario enters the first phase of its reopening after a punishing lockdown that lasted months and months. Customers are returning in droves with long lineups outside non-essential retailers in Ontario. We'll get the latest from the Toronto streets with CTV's Austin Delaney, then bring in pollster Nick Nanos with some exclusive reopening polling. Then a party in crisis.
This kind of departure doesn't happen overnight. There were discussions with the Prime Minister, with the Deputy Prime Minister, with local members as well. Those things don't happen overnight.
The Greens lost one of their three MPs yesterday as New Brunswick MP Jenica Atwin crossed the floor to join the Liberals. Why leave now and how will she reconcile some major party policy shifts? We'll break it down with our strategy session. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. The G7 family is back. Today, leaders gathered for the traditional G7 family photo. It's the first in-person G7 meeting since the start of the pandemic. But with all family reunions, expectations are high. As in-person diplomacy makes its comeback today, what is at stake for the leaders? Let's find out. And joining me now is CTV News senior parliamentary reporter Glenn McGregor from the UK. Hi there, Glenn. Good to see you. I know these are very busy days. What could you tell us about the 100 million vaccines that Canada has pledged to the world?
Yeah, well, Canada was planning to announce this on Sunday, but there was news reports saying that we were the only country of the G7 that hadn't gotten on side with this plan to provide a total of 1 billion vaccine doses from the G7 nations into the developing world. Canada was planning on making that announcement, but rushed it ahead today and said they're going to contribute 100 million doses of this vaccine. A lot of this, though, is previously announced money. Remember all that, the hundreds of millions of dollars that Canada pledged to the COVAX facility? Well, they're counting that as part of their contribution to this. But there will be a component of it that is made up of excess vaccines that Canada doesn't need. Of course, we've signed purchase agreements for far more vaccines than we'll ever use. So the idea is that will start to be redirected to developing nations once the rollout in Canada is finished, probably, Joyce, sometime in September, October.
That's interesting. And is there any talk, because there's a lot of it here in Canada, about vaccine passports or, you know, vaccine document that will attest that people who are traveling, because that is a big, you know, topic of conversation in the EU. What are you hearing about that?
We haven't heard a whole lot about that so far. And there seems to be a little bit of dissension around the G7 leaders table. The Americans aren't crazy about the idea. Canada is still kind of undecided on it. Ralph Goodale, the former Liberal cabinet minister, who's now the High Commissioner to the UK, came out and spoke to reporters today here in Falmouth and said that it's something that they're examining very closely. But so far, no agreement and really no progress on that file, Joyce.
I want to also ask you about the Prime Minister. So the Prime Minister had a virtual meeting with the Queen.
Yes.
So what did they talk about? And I know that he mentioned the GG. I know that Canada obviously looking for a GG. What did you hear? You got any scoops for us?
Yeah, this is sort of unusual. A virtual audience, they're calling it, with the Queen. I guess she does Zoom or FaceTime, and that's how they decided it was the safest way to have that conversation. The Queen is really up to speed on events in Canada, and when she meets with a prime minister, likes to get updated on what's happening. So in this instance, the prime minister updated her on the very sad story about the truck attack in London, Ontario, and also about the discovery of unmarked children's graves at the former residential school in Kamloops. But yes, they also did apparently talk about the GG. It was more a case, as I understand it, of the prime minister briefing her on the process by which they're going through and where they are in that process to select a new governor general, who, of course, be the Queen's representative in Canada. So he would have spoken to her about the development of this kind of short list of candidates that they now have, and probably laid out a timeline for her to tell her when there's going to be a new GG in place. I would imagine that's going to come probably sooner rather than later, because all this buzz about potential fall election, I think the government would prefer that there was a permanent person in the GG role rather than the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who's kind of filling in right now, so that when and if Trudeau has to go to the GG to ask that person to dissolve Parliament and trigger an election, he would rather it was someone who the Queen had signed off on and who was in the job permanently.
So very quickly, because I don't have a lot of time, but the Prime Minister hasn't spoken to reporters yet. You haven't heard from him at all. When are you expecting, first of all, why? And then secondly, when are you expecting to hear from him?
Yeah, typically at these kinds of summits, he gives a press conference on the last day. So he's going to be doing that on Sunday. And that's right before he flies to Brussels in Belgium for a meeting of NATO leaders to talk about national security. And then, of course, after that, he's in Brussels only a short time. But while he is there, he's planning a trip to the Pfizer plant. You know, most of the Pfizer vaccine that we're getting in Canada comes from a place called Pers, Belgium, which is a suburb of Brussels. So he's going to do a photo op there and check out the vaccine. And I don't think there's going to be any freebies given out, unfortunately. I know a lot of reporters who are traveling on the plane. Most of us have only had one shot. We'd probably love to get a second one. But unfortunately, Joyce, that's not going to be on offer. But then when he's finished in Belgium, flying back to Ottawa, he's going to have to spend at least one night in a airport hotel while he awaits for his negative COVID arrival test. And then we'll spend the rest of that balance of the 14-day quarantine at home.
CTV News senior parliamentary reporter Glenn McGregor, thanks so much. Take care of yourself, Glenn. Bon voyage.
Thanks, Joyce.
And as Glenn was just discussing, there's a push for the G7 to commit 1 billion vaccine doses, with half of that coming from the U.S. But most of these donations won't start rolling out until 2022. As leaders continue to say the pandemic won't be over anywhere until it's over everywhere, shouldn't those donations be accelerated? Let's bring in the MPs. Rob Oliphant is the Foreign Affairs Parliamentary Secretary. Michael Chong is the Conservative Party's Foreign Affairs Critic. And we have NDP Foreign Affairs Critic Jack Harris. Gentlemen, very nice to see you. Happy Friday to you. I'm going to start with you, Rob Oliphant, because Canada did not want to announce it yet. The Prime Minister wanted to announce it on Sunday, but then the news reports were saying that Canada was actually the only G7 country not giving these 100 million vaccines. My question is, why wait till next year?
Well, I think that the Prime Minister went to the G7 with three goals. His first goal was to make sure that we found a way to end this pandemic and to have a vaccine rollout that would make sense to the whole world. The second thing is to make sure we have an economic plan to build back better and to do that. And the third one is an environmental concern around making sure we have a pathway to a clean future. So he's taken those goals. Obviously, we've had the first day today. There's been news about vaccines. Canada will play its part. Canada will do its role. I have heard the number 100 million, as have you. I think details will come out on Sunday. Canadians want us to do two things. They want us to make sure that all Canadians are safe and healthy and vaccinated. and they want us to be generous to the world. And so this is what we're doing. We're getting Canadians vaccinated. We're on a pathway that is successful. And, you know, we're really leading the pack now on first doses. And we'll pick up on second doses. But we know that the pandemic's not over till it's over everywhere. So we'll do our share. And right now, the number that I'm hearing is 100 million doses will come from Canada. We obviously don't have domestic production, so they will be part of that procurement that we've been so successful at, and we'll be doing our part.
Jack Harris, I want to ask you, so Canada's pledging 100 million. I mean, the G7, it's 1 billion. Are we moving from vaccine nationalism to vaccine globalism? But, you know, 1 billion sounds huge. It is huge, but there are more than 1 billion vaccines needed out there.
Well, I mean, let me say two things. Obviously, you know, Canada, it sounds like Canada, it almost looks like Canada is being embarrassed and being the last one in. 100 million is a substantial number compared to the U.S.'s 500 million, given the size of our economy. So I don't think that that number is bad alone. But as you point out, 1 billion sounds like a lot, but there's probably 5 billion people in the world at least who are going to have trouble getting vaccinated. And as the Prime Minister himself says, and we all say, that nobody is safe until we're all safe. And if we don't make sure that the rest of the world gets that, this has to be considered a down payment for supporting the rest of the world. And I think this is would be the beginning, but the quicker that this is rolled out, the better, obviously.
Michael Chong, you know, it's a great announcement, you know, but should politically and a public health issue as well, should Canada wait till all those Canadians who want those two vaccines are fully vaccinated before starting to send them out? Or would that be politically dangerous not to do that?
Well, I'm not sure how great an announcement it is, because I agree with Jack. You know, there's some 5 billion people in the world that today that do not have access to vaccines. And so we need really 10 billion doses in order to inoculate these individuals, or else we're going to continue to be threatened by the virus coming back into Canada. And so this 1 billion commitment is only a tenth of the vaccines that are needed to stop this pandemic around the world. And Canada is only contributing one-tenth of that amount. And I would add that this reverses an earlier government decision to access the COVAX facility and use vaccines out of that facility that could have been used to help the world's poorest. So I think the government is just reversing some of the damage they did earlier when they accessed these vaccines from this facility.
Rob Oliphant, I'm curious. You know, this the big issue at this G7 is the pandemic, reopening economies, climate, China. What would be a win? This is the first really international meeting since the beginning of the pandemic, the first one in person. What define a win for this G7?
Well, a win for Canada will be a win for the world. What we recognize, and I want to go back a little bit on the fact that Canada provided early leadership on the COVAX mechanism. Canada, through Minister Carina Gould, was out in front right away, ensuring that the world would share its vaccines. There's no late to the party for Canada. Canada was first at the party with money and with constant response. So no late to the world. The success of this G7 will be the reality of having allies, 6 other allies of the G7, also this week at NATO and with the EU. The Prime Minister is doing 3 very important meetings. These are liberal democracies that are needing to get together because we have authoritarian regimes in the world. We need allies and friends to take on issues of climate, issues of authoritarianism, issues around human rights, making sure that we work with our allies to get Canada's position known. One of those is like around arbitrary detention. We have countries that are arbitrarily detaining citizens. We are working with countries. We've got dozens and dozens of countries now, some 50-some, that have agreed to be part of a protocol on arbitrary detention. We're working with the EU on that. We're working with our G7 partners on that. And we're continuing. So that's a win. Yeah. When Canada wins, the world wins. When the world wins, Canada wins.
So, Michael Chong, Rob just brought up the two Michaels, Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor. Is there anything in margin, obviously, of the G7 that the Prime Minister can do to try and help these two Canadians?
Well, Joyce, that's a great question. I think a win for Canada coming out of this summit would be for the Prime Minister to secure a one-on-one bilateral meeting with President Biden. There are so many issues in the bilateral relationship that need and Mr. Kovrig and Mr. Spavor, there's Mr. Schellenberg, Mr. Jalil, and there's also the issue of the ongoing issue of Line 5, which threatens to cut off much needed energy supplies for Ontario and Quebec, the issue of softwood lumber, the recent tariffs that the Biden administration has put on Canadian products. And so I think if the Prime Minister can get a one-on-one bilateral with the U.S. President that shows that the special relationship between Canada and the U.S. is strong, and I think we can see further action on those files.
Mike, Jack Harris, you know, very quickly, because we don't have a lot of time, this is one without Donald Trump. Is the G7 better off?
Well, I think the G7 is far better off without Donald Trump. First of all, there's some predictability, at least. You don't know, you're not wondering what's going to happen next. But I think the other thing with Mr. Biden is that there's a little sense that the other countries aren't so sure because they don't know how long there's going to be the kind of stability that Biden could provide. I think Michael is right that it's a good opportunity for Mr. Trudeau to communicate with Mr. Biden about these important issues. But the important thing coming out of this G7 has to be a significant demonstration that there is a sense of a joint project to ensure climate change is actually seriously treated by all countries, that's something that's locked down really solidly, and that Canada has some credibility playing a role in that. If we don't have that, then that's not very good for Canada, it's not very good for the world. That's very important. Security is clearly important in China, and I don't know if all of these things that Mr. Oliphant talked about are actually on the agenda for this meeting. I suspect many of them are not.
But climate is on the agenda. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. Rob Oliphant, Michael Chong, Jack Harris, thanks for sharing these thoughts with us, and have yourselves a wonderful and safe weekend, gentlemen.
Thank you, Joyce.
And one item on Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's G7 agenda today was to have his one-on-one meeting with his UK counterpart, Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Both leaders are pledging up to 100 million vaccine doses each to developing nations. Contrast that to the 500 million doses that US President Joe Biden pledged yesterday. But with Canada and the UK leading the G7 minus the US in vaccine rollout, can't these two countries ponying up more vaccines and sooner than next year? Let's ask British High Commissioner to Canada, Suzanne Lejeune d'Alguerzec. Welcome, High Commissioner, as usual. Lovely to see you.
Thank you. Nice to see you too.
I'm wondering if the UK, which is a vaccine producer, notably it produces the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, your country pledged 100 million doses of its vaccine surplus to developing nations. I'm wondering if there's a way to deliver them, because we're already hearing reactions from epidemiologists who are saying, this is wonderful, but it's a little bit too late.
So I think it's never too late. I think it's the sooner we can get them to the people who need them, the better. And at some of ours, I think 5 million doses are going to be distributed in the next 2 or 3 weeks. So some of them will get into people's arms very quickly indeed. But I think the fact that both the UK and Canada have now made this commitment is really important, because, you know, none of us are safe until we're all safe. This is a global problem which needs global responses. And I think that the G7 meeting has acted as a forcing mechanism to make sure that we all do our bit to make sure that we don't just look after our own populations, but that we spread our expertise, our money, and our vaccines more widely.
Yes, yes, indeed. You know, Health Minister Patty Hajdu says Canada is in talks with its G7 allies about vaccine passports or a vaccine document, if we don't like to call them passports. How much of a priority are those international standards for those vaccine documents for the UK government?
I think it's going to be on the agenda in Carbis Bay in Cornwall. It's one of the things that the leaders are talking about. But I think it's really important not to rush into something, because I think we need to make absolutely sure that if we are going to adopt some sort of passport, that we get it right. You know, there are precedents for how it's done, but we need to make sure that all the vaccines that are going to be certified are properly understood, that their benefits are understood, that their efficacy is understood. And I don't think that sort of decision-making and those sorts of investigations can be done quickly. We need to make sure that we do it right rather than do it very fast. But I think the principle of making sure that when people are vaccinated, they have some credible document to prove that they've been vaccinated is really important.
I want to take you on trade on another topic, High Commissioner. The two prime ministers also discussed the efforts to secure a free trade deal between Canada and the UK. There is already a continuation agreement, the two countries, to extend CETA, that's the trade deal with the EU, and extend it to the UK. So what more is there to negotiate, and how fast could this happen?
Well, the two prime ministers have committed to accelerating those negotiations, which is really welcome news, I think, in both countries. CETA is a great agreement, and we're delighted that we managed to preserve the benefits of CETA for us both with the continuity agreement. But, you know, CETA was an agreement that was negotiated by 28 countries and Canada, and it doesn't necessarily reflect our bilateral trade and investment relationship. And it's now getting on for 10 years old. So, you know, the world has changed. Things have evolved since then. And there are a lot of areas, I think, which we could improve on in terms of our bilateral trade relationship. So it's an exciting prospect. And I think we have the chance to make it a proper 21st century free trade agreement, covering things like digital trade, covering more services, mobility of people. So there's a lot of scope to make it a really good free trade agreement.
That's unfortunately all the time we have left. British High Commissioner to Canada, Suzanne Lejeune d'Alguerzec, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And the People's Party of Canada leader, Maxime Bernier, has been arrested in Manitoba for violating public health orders. Here's a video showing Bernier's arrest from his own Twitter account. The officer asks Bernier to step out of the vehicle for his arrest. Bernier agrees and exits the vehicle. A statement from the RCMP reads in part, Mr. Bernier knew of the health orders and received a ticket. The continuation of violating current public health orders in Manitoba has resulted in his arrest. He's charged under the Public Health Act for assembling in a gathering at an outdoor public place and for failing to self-isolate upon arrival in Manitoba. And coming up, a bit of normalcy has returned to Ontario.
It's been a year and a half since I've had a Corona on a patio, so it's pretty awesome.
The light at the end of the tunnel shines brightly in Ontario as people get out to hit a patio and shop after entering stage one of reopening. We'll head to Canada's biggest city next. Stay with PowerPlay. We've got a small return to normalcy in Ontario today, the province entering stage one of reopening at 12:01 a.m. Hours later, there was the reality at many stores that had been shuttered for so long, lines of shoppers snaking around buildings, hoping to snag a few deals. CTV's Austin Delaney has been out around town today, taking in the crowds. Welcome, Austin. You look like a happy man. I know that people around you are excited. What are you seeing?
Well, I'm happy to see everybody else happy. And when you say everybody else, it's the people in the patios behind me who are just starved to get out and meet some friends and have a beer, have a bite to eat, as well as the staff, the wait staff, the bartenders, and the owners. They've been closed for a long time. This has been a tough haul. And they need to get a beautiful day like this. The bar's opening at 12:01 this morning. Some of the bars in Toronto opening for 2 hours to cheers and countdowns. And then today at 11 o'clock this morning, you know, people started to come out to the bars. I'm in Little Italy right now, and that's because there was a soccer game. It's Euro Soccer. Italy was playing Turkey. It's normally really, really busy when the Italian team is playing. Cars coming back and forth. It's not like that today. The main cafe where people seem to flock to is Cafe Diplomatico. It only took reservations. It was sold out right away. There was a side area where you could come first come first serve. But by and large, there is space around if you're willing to wait a little bit of time. And now, you know, the crowd's moving along. The sun's coming down a little bit.
So our officials, I'm wondering about that, are officials concerned about COVID-19 measures being properly followed, you know, with those huge lineups? They started at midnight here in Ottawa as well. So I'm wondering, is there any concern about that?
Well, I think there should be concern just from what I saw. And you see people having a couple of drinks and it's four to a table. But then as the afternoon wears on and the game wears on, suddenly the people at this table are turned around talking to the people at that table and no one's wearing a mask anymore. The medical officer of health in Peel says he expects some sort of a spike. He doesn't know how big it'll be, but he says just the fact that people are going out, they're interacting with each other, it means the numbers are going to go up. How much they go up, well, we'll have to wait and see how that happens.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. CTV Toronto's Austin Delaney, thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
All right.
And enjoy. And as provinces reopen, the eventual return to normal in-person schooling is a key public health question. Schools across the country have been on a roller coaster of openings, partial openings, and total shutdowns over the last year. Now CTV has some exclusive polling on that eventual return. And a new poll from Nanos Research conducted for CTV's Power Play found that a majority of Canadians are opposed or somewhat opposed to allowing students who refuse a vaccine to return to class. So should the COVID-19 vaccine be made mandatory for in-class learning? Let's bring in Nick Nanos, the CEO of Nanos Research. Hi, Nick. How are you doing? What did you find out in that poll?
You know, you talked about a roller coaster ride, Joyce. I think you should have added white knuckle to that for parents and for students over the last year. In the new Power Play Nanos survey that it's just being released right now, when we asked Canadians whether they supported or opposed allowing students that are not vaccinated to go back to school in person, you can see that 6 out of every 10 oppose or somewhat oppose, and only 35% or 34% that is support or somewhat support. But what's interesting, Joyce, is there's some significant variations depending on which generation you ask. If you talk to Canadians who are 35 to 54, it's much closer in terms of being divided, and it's probably because those are folks with kids who want their kids to go to school and have some sort of normalization. But if you look at older Canadians, they're more likely to oppose or somewhat oppose unvaccinated children going to school in person.
So obviously, you know, the pandemic experience has not been uniform across the country. So how did your numbers break down by region?
Well, what we found out was that generally there was some variation by region, but the one outlier, and we've seen this across all of the surveys that we've done during the pandemic, have been the Prairie provinces. The Prairie provinces have been most likely not only to be anxious about what I'll say the pandemic and the federal response and being unhappy with that, they're least likely, what I'll say, to support any kind of blocking of individuals from going to school. So they would be the one outlier. But, you know, beyond the Prairies, the biggest and probably most important number is that parents are probably divided. That means that come next September, it could be very awkward. There could be friction. There could be disagreement. And there could be some uncertainty where there are parents who really want to make sure that the kids are all vaccinated, and other parents that might not be 100% in terms of making that mandatory for any student to attend school in person.
I'm imagining the debate that will start happening in August over this issue, if some kids go back to school and they're not vaccinated. Nick Nanos, thanks for taking the time to talk to us. Have a great weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
And coming up, is the grass truly greener on the other side? Our panel of strategists will weigh in on Green MP Jenica Atwin crossing the floor and joining the Liberals. Can the Green Party survive this blow to their ranks? Stay with Power Play.
She did not refer to any particular person as the source of her leaving. And I think it is important to underline that the discussions between Ms. Atwin and the Liberal Party had been going on for at least several weeks, as far as we know, and predated any of these posts, either hers or anyone else afterward.
And welcome back. The Green Party's loss is the Liberals' gain. MP Jenica Atwin rather crossed the floor yesterday, leaving behind a party threatening to tear itself apart. It's a win for the Liberals, obviously, with days left before the House rises for the summer. Can the Green Party recover? Let's bring in our strategist, Greg McEachran from Proof Strategies Leans Liberal. The Toronto Sun's editor-in-chief, Adrian Batra, has a conservative perspective. Anne McGrath is the NDP's national director. And Greg Weston from Ernst Cliff Strategy Group is our neutral voice. Hello, Strats. Happy Friday. Love to see you. Can't wait till you'll be in the studio here. But in the meantime, this will have to do. So, to Anne, I want to ask you this. I know that the NDP, according to Thomas Mulcair, the former leader of the party, doesn't take floor crossers. But would it have been good for the NDP to have someone like Jenica Atwin cross the floor to your party?
Well, I would say no, because I think that clearly if she feels more comfortable with the Liberals, she wouldn't be very comfortable in the NDP. So no, it wouldn't have been good for us for her to do that. And also it wouldn't have been acceptable. I mean, we have a very longstanding policy position that is basically a violation of the trust that the voters have put in somebody. And so, you know, I think voters don't like it. I think it contributes to this idea that politics is a game, and it's not a game. It's very serious. And as we can see during this pandemic, what politicians do has a direct impact on people's lives. So I don't think you should be able to do this. I think that in her case, she probably should have stepped down, either sat as an independent or run in a by-election for the Liberal Party. That's not who voters did not vote for, a Liberal MP in that riding, and she should not have done that. And I think that it will come back. I don't think it's ever justifiable, in my view. And you know, I also don't know if there is any particular policy position. It sounds really more like it was problems with the internal strife in the Green Party, which I can imagine is difficult to take, but they have had a lot of internal disagreements over the last little while.
That's really interesting, actually, Greg McEachran. You know, we're all thinking, well, this is a great boost for the Liberals strategically in New Brunswick, you being an expert on, you know, politics in the Atlantic provinces. How much of a boost is it? And what Anne just said about, you know, people's trust, will that play into it? I mean, she won the seat from a Liberal. Will a Liberal win back that seat? Like, how is it playing over there?
Well, of the three maritime provinces in the last election, New Brunswick is where the Liberals took the biggest hit. They had the most seat loss. And in the case of Fredericton, which is a seat that swings back and forth, the Liberal came third, actually, so behind the Green, behind the Conservatives. So I think it is a big boost. It is a good message to send. I think you know, if you're a liberal going into this election, and we talked a little bit last week about non-COVID election items, the environment is one that the liberals want to really stress. And I think, you know, based on some comments around Bill C-12 this week, I think it's one the NDP, you know, obviously a strength for them as well. So I think having a new green MP come in is obviously a good thing. Floor crossing, though, is always in the eye of the beholder. I worked for Belinda Stronach as a Liberal MP. I heard awful things said about her by Conservatives. Yet when Stephen Harper won, David Emerson crossed the floor right away, right into cabinet. It wasn't great for David Emerson, I don't think, but it showed how quickly your position can change on floor crossing, depending on whether you're losing an MP or gaining one.
So, Adrian Batra, the Green Party is obviously in trouble. They're left with two MPs in British mm-hmm. Columbia. She was a star candidate. She didn't even give, Annamie Paul, the leader, a call before the news conference, just to say, look, this is happening. She found out through journalists that her candidate had left. So if you were their advisor, how do you fix that?
Well, I would say that more speaks to her character than it does than the leader of the Green Party. Greg just brought up Belinda Stronach. It's not dissimilar to what Belinda Stronach did to Stephen Harper back in the day when she went over and crossed the floor to Paul Martin. But, you know, these Anne rightly brought up this whole notion that the public thinks this is just a big game and, you know, the floor crossing. And yes, everybody does it. And I'm not saying it's right. But when you are on the receiving end, you take that MP or MPP or MLA with generally open arms, and the Liberals are in a minority situation, so they want to have as many numbers as they possibly can. But it would seem to me that this particular MP has some particularly adverse views with respect to Israel. I'm shocked that she felt comfortable going into the Liberal Party. But, you know, the overall notion of leaving and not giving someone the heads up, or they afford them the opportunity to at the very least prepare to respond, is less about the leader of the Green Party and more about the MP. Now, the Green Party has problems, for sure. I think that there was a lot of excitement when the new leader came in. She brought some new promise to them. They're going to struggle in the next election with just two MPs on the roster. I suspect they will present a whole roster for Canadians, a whole slate, but electability is problematic for them.
Yeah, it is. And that's where you come in, Greg Weston. We both remember when the Progressive Conservatives had two MPs, but that was the Progressive Conservatives. How can they come back from this? There was a lot of talk for them in 2019. How do they come back from this?
Well, Joyce, sort of recovering says that you have fallen somewhere. The Greens don't have very far to fall. A defection like this, especially when we're probably within months of an election, is always embarrassing for a party. It sends all the wrong messages to your campaign workers that you want to inspire. And watching one of your three MPs leave the House and go to somebody else's party is not inspiring. But let's keep this in perspective. It's the Green Party. It's been around. It's been fielding candidates in federal elections for 40 years. For 20 years, they went from zero to about 4% of the popular vote. And last time I checked, in the last 20 years, they've skyrocketed from 4 to 6%, roughly. So this is a party that has a lot more inherent problems than defections. And let's remember that for 30 of those 40 years, they had nobody in Parliament. Elizabeth May was the first one elected in 2011. They've been around since 1983. So they get along just fine without MPs, and whether one of them is coming or one of them is going is not likely to change the political landscape that much. It's just embarrassing, mainly for the leader.
Absolutely. I'm going to leave it at that. We're going to come back with you guys, but coming up, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau returns to the global stage. As Trudeau becomes one of the veteran leaders of the G7, will the Prime Minister get overshadowed by the newest member of the club, U.S. President Joe Biden? Our Strat panel returns after this break. Stay with Power Play. Canada is back. That is what Prime Minister Justin Trudeau famously said back in 2015. Now that in-person international diplomacy is back with the return of the G7 Leaders Summit, will Canada be overshadowed by the new kid on the block, U.S. President Joe Biden? Or will the other leaders look to Canada's example as we lead G7 countries in first dose vaccinations? Let's bring back our strategist. Greg McCachran is here. Adrian Batra is here. Anne McGrath and Greg Weston. Hello again. Greg McCachran, I want to start with you. How important was it for Justin Trudeau to attend this G7 summit in person?
Hugely important. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago, Joyce, that there, you know, in one way, this is the first G7 since Charlevoix in 2018, because in 2019, there wasn't a communique. 2020, Trump didn't host one. Remember in Charlevoix, you know, what happened? Trump insulted the Japanese prime minister, withdrew from the Paris Agreement, was in trade disputes with us and other countries. So I think this is hugely important to kind of reset the relationship. I think the government of France actually called that G7 G6 plus one because the United States was so far off field from every other country. So I think it's a good reset in the relationship of the G7, as well as issues around vaccinating countries that are poorer. And, you know, I think Glenn McGregor had spoken to you earlier that the news has kind of leaked out that Canada will be part of that announcement. I believe, you know, the cat's out of the bag, whether it comes out Sunday or not, we're in that agreement.
Absolutely. Adrian, I want to ask you, so the prime minister is not fully vaccinated. He did not want to take a second vaccine before other Canadians. Should he have gone there with two vaccines?
Well, I mean, that would have been ideal. But, you know, again, we are in a country that found itself in a situation where we were not getting the procurement and enough and quickly enough at that time. And so, look, even the prime minister is a victim of that. But I appreciate the fact that he's not going to have to quarantine in a hotel, those awful hotels, but nor should any other Canadian. So we're glad that that policy, actually, that hand got forced. But, you know, I think it's good that he's got one dose. We know that from epidemiologists, the coverage with one dose is quite significant. Probably be right in time for his second when he gets back. But again, you know, Greg has mentioned this before. These world leaders are so cloistered. They're not going to go with the battery of people they normally go with. They're going to be very safe, very cautious about who they are around, their interactions and all of that. And I'm pretty sure they'll all be still wearing their masks. But I just hope that Prime Minister Trudeau goes over there and yes, resets helps reset the G7, but also get support from our allies to get some support to get our Michaels out of the clutches of China. That would be very helpful.
Yes, indeed. And will he even bring it up with the U.S. president? And I want to ask you about those 100 million vaccines, 500 million from the United States, 100 million from the U.K. The number seems huge, a billion. But epidemiologists, again, I'll ask you that question, are saying it's too not fast enough. Is there a way that these countries should start sending these vaccines or helping developing countries get them faster?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we've said it before. It's almost like it's an enlightened self-interest, right? You know, they always say when you're on an airplane, you know, you put your mask on and then the other, but you need everybody to have a mask. And in the case of this particular virus, it's clear that none of us are safe unless all of us are safe. So it is absolutely in Canada's interest, not only to make sure that everybody here gets the two doses of vaccines, but also that everybody else gets them. Because, you know, and we've seen even just with the way that the variants have arrived and spread, that we will not be able to have a kind of a post-pandemic world or even a way of dealing with it until all countries have access to the vaccines that they need. So it is in Canada's interest to do this. It's in every country's interest to do this. So I think that it has to be as fast and as many as possible.
Greg Wesson, you've covered a few of these trips, these G7s. I'm wondering how complicated is for the prime minister, for instance, to get a one-on-one on with Joe Biden, and to get something to come back to Canada or to be able to announce something, for instance, on the two Michaels. That would be a huge win for the two men who have been in jail for hundreds of days and for the prime minister.
Well, a lot of this, as we know, is worked out ahead of time, Joyce. And sometimes the breakthroughs are something that happens there. And that's why it's important for them to physically be there, because sometimes what's not in the choreographed script that the officials from the various countries have worked out ahead of time, it happens just by chance. And we've seen this at lots of these G7 meetings, that's what happened. For something to happen for the two Michaels in this means the United States would have to withdraw the charges against Meng Wanzhou, presumably. The Huawei executive here, is that likely to happen in an accidental gathering at this meeting? Unlikely. Part of the political strategy of all this, of course, is managing expectations, which is why there's no speculation on achieving very much of anything. So whatever they come back with is better than nothing. But yeah. To expect something like that, as complex as that, to come out of this meeting would be pretty extraordinary.
That's unfortunately, guys, all the time we have left for this Friday. Greg McCachran, Adrian Batra, Anne McGrath, Greg Weston, thank you for being there. And thank you for being part of our day, our afternoon today. This is us. Goodbye. Happy weekend. And see you on Monday.